Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Tom Pearson, and he's doing a session entitled Evolution, Creationism, and the Nature of Science. So let's listen in on Tom.
It really is a real good outline for just what evolution is and how science today looks at the evolution of life on Earth, right up to where we as human beings came from and how we fit in the most recent research and how we fit into the whole family tree of life. The title is suggestive that he is somewhat against creationism, and we'll talk about that viewpoint here in a minute.
Evolution and myth of plants.
And the myth of creationism. Both of these books were in the bookstore a little earlier, although this one was only had a few copies left, so may still be. Well, we can begin the tape now. My name's Tom Pearson. I'm a geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Vancouver, Washington, and my main work is with research on volcanoes, primarily related to hazards of volcanoes and assessing hazards. And more I'm getting into this nebulous in-between area of how to communicate hazards information effectively to public officials and the public at large. And most of the rest of this week is going to be more on this hazards topic, some things I'd like to share with you about that. Today I've really jumped into a big topic. And I've kind of broken down on the board there how I want to tackle it. My hope is just to kind of give you the broadest of outlines about evolution, what it is, how it fits with, how the nature of science in itself has allowed humans to reach these kinds of conclusions, what the processes are. And then to look at what is called scientific creationism today and some problems that I think are very fundamental with that approach, especially as a scientist and also as a Christian. And then maybe at the end, if we have time to kind of get along to some of these really interesting questions about how life might have begun on Earth. And I'll just throw out some evidence and results of some fairly recent experiments that I've done, which really have intriguing implications. Lots of big question marks all through this session today, and I'm hoping that you will feel free to, just jump right in with any questions that you have as we go along. So I will start then with the first topic of how science works. What is the scientific endeavor? And I'll start by using a very simple example, which is actually the way Barris starts off in his book here. Imagine you're going into a dark room. You flip the light switch, expecting the lights to go on, and nothing happens. You say to yourself, aha, the light didn't go on. And that is the first step in the scientific process. And that is the statement of the problem. You can't progress in science unless you have identified what the problem is you're trying to solve. Then you think about it momentarily and conclude, well, maybe the switch, maybe there's a little dirt in the switch or something that's not making contact. So you devise an experiment. You're devising a hypothesis. You're building a hypothesis. And that is that the reason the light's not working is because the switch is faulty. So you immediately formulate a little experiment to test that hypothesis, and you go to the switch and you flip it up and down a few times and see if that breaks any dirt loose and makes it come on. Well, if nothing happens, you say, well, that wasn't it, and you reject your first hypothesis. And then you backtrack a little bit, and then you move on to thinking about, well, what else could it be? And you try to formulate another hypothesis. And that might be, well, maybe the light bulb's burned out, or maybe the fuse is blown. And so in each of those cases, in this very simple little problem, which you're doing just automatically without thinking about it, you are paralleling what we call the scientific method. Finally, maybe it's the light bulb, and maybe you go to the cupboard, you come out with a brand new light bulb, you screw it in, and the light goes on when you flip the switch this time. Well, thereby, your hypothesis is confirmed, and so your theory, you're working, then it's moved from a hypothesis to a status called theory, and that's your belief that this is what the ultimate reason for the problem was. We might be tempted to say, well, the fact of the matter is, or the literal truth of this whole exercise is, that it was the bulb. But in science, we very seldom feel able to do that. And in fact, even in this simple example, that might not have actually been the case. Imagine, for example, the power had been out down the street. Somebody slammed into a telephone pole with a car and it knocked down a line. And just at the moment you had, or in between the time you tried the switch for the last time and when you'd actually screwed in the light bulb, maybe the power had come back on. And so, in fact, the original light bulb might have been good, and you reached the conclusion that it was the light bulb when, in fact, it wasn't. So the scientific method is what we call this whole process in a very formalized way, where great care is taken along each step of the way, and data is collected carefully, and it's analyzed for its validity, and the hypotheses are tested in very carefully recorded and controlled experiments. But it's the same framework of steps, the same progression of steps that allow us to come to a conclusion about how something is or how something works. And to actually come up with a theory, what we need to do is have many different tests, many different experiments, all reaching the same conclusion. And only when there's been some passage of time and a lot of work going into the process do we elevate a hypothesis to the status of theory. And this is how science works. This is how science moves along, incrementally, step by step, with this very careful process of elimination we call the scientific method. When a theory is formed and published, and I should state that all of this has to happen in the light of public view through a process of publication in scientific journals for other scientists to see. When a theory is put out there, even when some hypotheses are put forward, they become targets. Because this whole area of science is a very competitive one. And I'm sure you're aware that money is tight. The National Science Foundation doesn't have unlimited supplies, and universities don't have all that much money to pay scientists. So the competition is pretty intense out there to come up with a little piece of the limelight. And one way to get that is to knock down somebody else's theory. I mean, you can get an awful lot of credit by doing that. So, you know, theories have to be pretty well founded. A lot of very careful work has to go into them. Sometimes they are knocked down. And as I used as an example in my sessions last week, a tremendous revolution in earth sciences, in the science of geology, occurred about 30 years ago, when the then existing theory of how the Earth's crust was formed and built mountains and all these processes went on. That was totally turned upside down by a new theory called the theory of plate tectonics. And it allowed geologists to suddenly see a totally different way of looking at things, and it also gave them a model by which they could much better explain many of the things that they didn't very well understand before. So the theories are instrumental in helping us understand things better, and no theory is sacrosanct. Everything is a target and available for possible criticism. There are people who cheat occasionally in science. I mean, scientists are human beings, and some people try to garner credits without going to the hard work of really doing it. Some people fabricate data. But because of the very nature of the scientific method, that it has to be published, it has to be open for other people to look at and to challenge, these guys are always caught. Well, pretty much always caught. There was one of the skulls, and I even forget the name of the exact one right now, in the early debates of anthropology.
Piltdown.
The Piltdown man, that's the one, was a forgery that lasted for quite a few decades before it was proven to be a forgery. But I think ultimately, because of the nature of the scientific method, any attempts at forgeries or falsification will eventually come to light. And I believe that no aspect of human endeavor is more open to scrutiny and to criticism and to challenge than science is. Now, the theory of evolution has stood the test of all this shooting at it for 136 years now. And it still is firmly entrenched as the primary working model for how life has come to be and how, in fact, it works even today. And the theory of evolution is instrumental in some of the thinking that goes on in genetic research and the new directions that biologists are going in today. So not only does it explain the past, but a good theory is very helpful in predicting the future and directing new scientific research. So what is evolution? Lots of things evolve. Basically, evolution means that something changes with time. The English language evolves. What we speak today is not the English that Shakespeare spoke or wrote in. The design of automobiles evolves. Fords don't look the same today as they looked 40 or 50 years ago. And in fact, there's a very drastic difference if we take a Model A Ford and a 1995 Ford Taurus. They're pretty different looking, and you might say, well, how did one get from one to the other? But if you go each year from one model to the next to the next to the next, you can see the progression by which those incremental changes added up to one big change. And the theory of evolution, what we talk about as the theory of evolution today, is really more specifically the theory of evolution of species of plants and animals by what we call natural selection. And that was the contribution that Darwin and his contemporary Alfred Russel Wallace contributed to our understanding of biology. In fact, these two guys were working independently. Darwin, as you may know, traveled extensively in South America in the 1830s, collected a lot of data, filled lots of notebooks, got some ideas, but then kind of sat on that information for a while because it was so, the ideas he was coming up with were so dramatic and so counter to what scientists believed at the time that he was very hesitant to do anything with it, to publish it.
Coming up against the church.
And he was coming up against the church.
That, kind of revolution.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And then there was a younger biologist, this guy Wallace, Alfred Russel Wallace, also an Englishman, who was kind of a protege of Darwin's. He communicated, he corresponded a lot with Darwin, had just the tremendous respect and admiration for Darwin. And he went off and did some of his expeditions in Asia. And he started collecting samples of animals and fossils in somewhat a parallel track with Darwin, and he started coming up with the same kinds of ideas. And then Darwin realized that this guy might scoop him on this whole idea of natural selection. So, and maybe it's because, you know, the English are real gentlemen, a compromise was reached that both of these guys would read their papers simultaneously, at least in the same scientific meeting in London in 1858, which they did. And so, really, it was a simultaneous and independent reaching of conclusion about natural selection by these two scientists. Darwin has since taken most of the limelight for this because just the next year, since he'd been working on it for so long, he had a lot of ammunition kind of right there and waiting in the wings. And he came out with his book, The Origin of Species, the following year. And that just took the scientific world by storm. And so we really think of the concept associated with Darwin. In essence, what natural selection is, there's kind of four basic assumptions, observations that Darwin and Wallace made. One is that in any plant or animal, more offspring are produced than actually are able to survive. And in lower ordered forms, things like certain fish and worms and in some plants, vastly greater numbers of seeds or you know, little tadpoles or whatever are produced than actually will survive to adulthood. Darwin also observed that no two individuals, with the exception of identical twins, are exactly the same. He said that there was variation between individuals. And he then concluded that, well, if there is overpopulation originally, there must be some form of competition between all these individuals that allows some to survive and some not to survive. And he concluded that the variations that were favorable to survival would, in the long term, help those individuals to survive. And whereas those with unfavorable variations in the long term would not survive, and therefore those traits would not get passed on to their offspring, whereas the traits of the ones who had good and favorable variations would get passed on. You know, maybe it would be something like some animal had a little bit thicker fur and was able to stay a little warmer in the wintertime than some of his siblings. And I have to stress that these changes, generation to generation, are minute and very, very small. And just having a favorable variation would not guarantee survivability. But chance is going to play a big role in this too. But Darwin figured that in the long term, with the rules of probability at work, that in the long term, those with the favorable characteristics would be favored for survival. And so the long-term consequence of this process of natural selection going on from time to time would be what we call today biological evolution. And we know today that this evolution occurs by mutation of genes in our chromosomes or in the chromosomes of any animal or plant. These random changes in the genes that allow changes in body function or type or size or whatever to occur. Let me stop there and just throw it out. Do you have any questions about this overall outline? Yeah.
I understand longer fur and so on like that, but how do you describe a fish suddenly sprouting a leg and walking up on land? How does that happen?
Well, it wouldn't happen exactly like that. It would be a very, very small, a very small incremental change that would be slightly beneficial to survival. Even today, there are some fish that will wriggle up onto a beach to lay their eggs in the sand above water level, and then they kind of wriggle back into the water when they're done. It's a strategy they have for protecting their eggs from predation from other animals. Presumably, and the fossil record kind of bears this out, because there have been a number of fossils found that are somewhat, the missing links between fish and amphibians. Some of these early fish developed pectoral, whatever those fins are. I'm not a biologist.
Lobe
fins.
Is what they were.
Yeah. These fins that are tanned down on the side, they're analogous to our forelimbs. And they, in most fish, they're just fins, but in some of these fish, they got to be pretty strong, and they had pretty good muscular muscles developed on them. And those fins would actually help them crawl up onto land. And that must have been an adaptation that was favorable, and so eventually, through many, many, many generations, thousands of generations, this change could have evolved into what we have as legs. Because all the bones are still there. The bones in the fin of a fish are basically the same as the bones in our arms and legs, except that they've changed a lot in their form, but the basic numbers and structures are still there. And also, as we go through our evolution as from an egg to an embryo and growing inside our mothers to a fully developed human being, we pass through these stages, which are very, very similar to the stages passed through by these what we call lower life forms today. And in fact, in the early stages of development, an embryonic fish is almost identical to an embryonic human being. They're very, very similar.
We all had gills at one stage.
That's right, we do. As an embryo, we each had gills. And then those dropped off, and we continued to develop, whereas the fish did not. Any other questions? Well, let me charge on here. Let's tackle then, what is scientific creationism? Scientific creationism is a belief that the creation story, as told in Genesis, is literally true. And those who call themselves scientific creationists today believe that it is possible to interpret and to use scientific evidence to support the idea that the world was created as it's stated exactly in Genesis. So in other words, their hypothesis is that the Genesis story is the pattern, and they're trying to use evidence in support of that hypothesis. However, there's some problems. One is that their hypothesis, the Genesis story, as it is in the Bible, is not something we can test by experiment. Now, there's no way we can go to that hypothesis and say, well, there's an experiment I can do, or there's a prediction I can make that I can test that will either prove or disprove it. And to be the scientific method, a hypothesis has to have that property. In other words, you have to give people a chance to prove it or disprove it. And by its nature, the statement of creation is just a statement, and the creationists believe that we have to just accept that. Let me just read a statement by a fellow, named Henry Morris, who is a director of the Institute for Creation Research in San Diego. And this is a statement he published. It is precisely because biblical revelation is absolutely authoritative and perspicacious that the scientific facts, rightly interpreted, will give the same testimony as that of Scripture. There is not the slightest possibility that the facts of science can contradict the Bible, and therefore there is no need to fear that a truly scientific comparison of any aspect of the two models of origins can ever yield a verdict in favor of evolution. So basically, now he's kind of going at it with his mind made up that this has to be the way it is, and we're just going to use the evidence to try to support that. And that simply is not the scientific method, and it's not science. Also, a literal interpretation of Genesis poses some problems, and I have not heard how the creationists have addressed this, and that is that there are two creation stories in Genesis, one in the first chapter and one in the second chapter. In the first one, which is the, you know, God worked for 6 days and rested on the seventh, in that sequence, God created the animals first, and then at the end created man. And it's interesting, if we view that that creation story as metaphor, it's very interesting that that general sequence is very, very much parallel to the sequence of evolution that we see via the scientific method. So maybe that's one way we can view it. In the second creation story, basically the Garden of Eden story, in that, God creates man first, and then creates helpmates for the man, and starts with animals and ends up with woman. But in that sequence, he creates the animals and the birds first, or after he creates man. And if one were really stuck with a literal interpretation and justifying these two, I don't know how you'd get around that problem. Creationists basically operate in trying to promote their views by looking for errors and inconsistencies in normal science, and finding fault with it, and then by exclaiming that here is the fault, then by that logic, then say, well, then we can't believe evolution. They're trying to chip away at the evidence. But in all cases that I have run across where scientists have been allowed or able to refute the claims that they've made in their publications, they've all turned out to be either misinterpretations of scientific data or misunderstandings or things taken out of context. And in some cases, it's been kind of outright fraud. For example, there's a picture of dinosaur footprints that appears in some creationist books, where they have dinosaur footprints next to human footprints. And when those were examined, it turned out that someone had gone in and filled in other dinosaur footprints with sand, shaped human footprints in the sand, and then stood back and photographed them next to the dinosaur footprints. So it's just not science. And to me, what I see as a threat of this for us and for our children is that, you know, it's fine if somebody wants to believe it, I believe that's fine, and I have no qualms with that, but it's just not science. And that if someone wants to put it on a par with science and have it taught in schools, I think that seriously diminishes the teaching of science to our kids. And I think they should be kept separate. Maybe you have some thoughts on that too. I'd like to, if you do, just chime in. Yeah.
I do. It seriously diminishes our understanding of literature and of the Bible as literature, and as Scripture, too. And so not only does it diminish science, it diminishes what Scripture is meant to be, because if we read this story and throw it out. Well, I don't believe that. And then we can, then what about this, this, and this? And we fail to differentiate between all the different genres of literature that make up the Bible, the poetry, the history, and the history and the fiction that are mixed together, and the myth. So we're doing an injustice to the whole reading process, too. And, as I've dealt with in my own kids, we're doing the process. Because it affects, well, I can't believe that, but can I believe it?
Yes.
I guess what I have trouble grappling with is why that's so important for people to believe in whatever they believe in, that the earth was created in 7 days. And there's so much of the Bible that is literature and not, you know, was, I would think, never taught to be taken literally, and why that has become so important to these people. I haven't been able to understand the thinking in that. And so I don't know if there's an answer to that question, but that it's like much to do about nothing. Why is that so important? It doesn't diminish the Bible, I don't think. And we're not trying to say there's nothing wrong with the Bible. When we say maybe we believe in something,
I have not done extensive reading on the theological side of this. Maybe some of you have. My impression is that the inherited adherence to the creationist way of looking at things are tend to be members of fundamentalist denominations that, as a fundamental precept of their whole belief system, they believe that they have to interpret the Bible as literal truth. And that's part of the foundation of their faith. So they are going to great efforts to try to fit that in.
And they even have to fit in science to that too. They have to make science into this monolithic thing that never changes. I mean, it's crazy because they're doing exactly opposite to me what they want to do, because to authenticate their belief, they have to call it scientific.
Right.
Right.
And it's not scientific at all.
Yeah, it's not faith anymore.
Yeah.
One of the issues here, and what some of the mischief has to do with the way terms are conflated and subtly change meaning. A lot of times in the theological literature, there's a distinction, and it's used in a variety of ways, but often made the distinction between evolution E and evolution with a capital E. The small e referring essentially to a descriptive process, the larger E to a materialistic understanding of the world, and that is, in essence, there is no intentionality to the world. We're not going anywhere. All we have is matter in motion. So in essence, there's a certain thing that you can call a scientific fundamentalist that glides from the data, scientific judgments, to making a religious decision. To say this is how it happened is one thing. To say there's no intentionality in the process, that's not a scientific statement. That's a religious statement, and people have a right to confess their faith. But I think the interesting irony is that the two fundamentalists deserve each other. that, because, as you were saying, the religious fundamentalists tend to, in essence, concede the field to the scientists. To say, okay, well, we're going to play on this ball field where we authenticate knowledge by the scientific method, which is precisely what they don't want to do, and they often don't recognize that, even as the scientific fundamentalists are rapidly making religious statements and denying that they're doing it. And I think that's part of the confusion that we have when we talk about this, is that we're using terms really in different ways and kind of passing one another.
One of the things that was pointed out to me by a geologist who has written extensively on methods of dating rocks using radioactive decay. And he's a world expert in it and has been called to testify in numerous court battles with regard to having creationism taught in schools on an equal par with science and evolution. And his point is that these folks are not dumb. I mean, they're a lot of PhDs, a lot of very intelligent people. They have very strong beliefs, and their arguments, at least on the surface, sound very convincing. And it's a force that really we need to contend with, and not just necessarily just sort of write them off as a radical fringe that won't have much impact, because they could. And in fact, their strategy apparently now, since in 1987, the Supreme Court ruled in the Louisiana case, a law that they had in Louisiana where creationism had to be taught together with evolution in biology classes. That was knocked down by the Supreme Court. Since then, the strategy has been to go to individual school boards around the country and try to convince school boards to adopt textbooks that have the scientific creationist viewpoint in them. So I think it's really relevant, continues to be really relevant today. Okay, let me put evolution in context here quickly of geologic time. And in those handouts I passed out, there's a chart that gives all the names, which are not really important to us here. It also gives some ages and numbers, in hundreds of millions of years or billions of years. And in some ways, that's not very relevant to us, too, because it's real hard to imagine numbers of the magnitude and size that we're talking about. You'll notice on there, too, there are little events that happened in the history of the world when the dinosaurs appeared and when they became extinct and all that, which is kind of interesting. But let me just take that whole period of geologic time from about 4.5 billion years ago, when scientists believed that the Earth was created, from the gravitational attraction and accumulation of dust that was spinning around the sun, to today, and we'll compress that whole time into one year, one hypothetical year. Let me just read a paragraph that puts all these some of these events into that perspective. Compress the entire 4.6 billion years of geologic time into a single year. On that scale, the oldest rocks we know date from about mid-March. Living things first appeared in the sea in May. Land plants and animals emerged in late November. And the widespread swamps that form the Pennsylvanian coal deposits flourished for about 4 days in early December. Dinosaurs became dominant in mid-December, but disappeared on the 26th, at about the time the Rocky Mountains were first uplifted. Man-like creatures appeared sometime during the evening of December 31st. And the most recent continental ice sheets began to recede from the Great Lakes area and from northern Europe about 1 minute and 15 seconds before midnight on the 31st. Rome ruled the Western world for 5 seconds, from 1159-45 to 1159-50. Columbus discovered America 3 seconds before midnight, and the science of geology was born with the writings of James Hutton just slightly more than 1 second before the end of our eventful year of years. So there's a lot of time involved here.
I've heard it in terms of distance. If the evolutionary period is a 50-foot distance, I would guess about the length of this building, man has existed for the thickness of a postage stamp.
I have a favorite one I do where we take an inch is equal to 5,000 years, basically the time of recorded human history. And then we sort of march on down the road. Let's see, I get my things right here. Dinosaurs became extinct about 0.2 miles down the road. Land plants and animals first appeared 1.4 miles down the road. But the birth of the Earth was almost 15 miles down the road. And it's interesting. Even the very oldest rocks that we find have some evidence of life in them. the very oldest sedimentary rocks, which are metamorphosed, and so they were squeezed and recrystallized enough to blot out any actual fossils, still have elevated carbon ratios, indicating there was some photosynthetic activity going on when the carbon was fixed in these rocks. The oldest fossils we have date back to about 3.6 billion years ago. And this is, these were what we call stromatolites. They're big mounds that formed from a blue-green algae and bacteria living together in a kind of symbiotic relationship and mixed with sediment. And they would build up almost like coral reefs. But in fact, these things exist today. Same basic structures and the same animals and plants that make them, they can be found off the coast of Australia today. And then for 2.4 billion years, you know, the big chunk of our eventful year there, all life forms, as far as we can determine from the fossil record, were single-cell creatures. And not only that, but the cells themselves were what are called prokaryotic cells. They were very simple cells. They didn't have a cell nucleus, and they didn't have the other organelles inside the cell, like mitochondria and chromosomes and that sort of thing. And then 1.4 billion years ago, complex cells appeared, ones with cell nuclei. But then, then about 700 million years ago, the first multicellular animals appeared. And these are still hotly debated by paleontologists. They appear to have been something like sea fans today, or kind of like flat sponges that would be anchored sort of on the seafloor and just kind of wave in the currents. Some paleontologists believe that they did not continue on past a few 100 million years, and so they died out. So it was kind of a false start for multicellular life on Earth. And then about 570 million years ago, there is this incredible event on Earth where life literally explodes into being almost. The rocks start at the beginning of the Cambrian period, and you know that's shown on your little chart there. Suddenly, in the rocks of that age and younger, there is incredible diversity of life forms. There are all kinds of things. And not only that, some of them have hard shells and are well preserved. A common one that you read about sometimes are trilobites. They're little guys that were half an inch to maybe 3 or 4 inches long. They kind of looked a little bit like horseshoe crabs. They had, you know, 8 legs and a hard shell, and they'd skitter about on the floor of the seas and scavenge for food. But it's almost a sudden hairline division between very, very simple forms and very complex forms, and we don't have a good explanation for that. Part of it is that we believe that in the Precambrian, the life forms didn't have the hard shells and therefore weren't well preserved. But scientists or paleontologists are getting pretty good at finding some of these other forms with soft bodies in some of these shales, and they tend to be very, very simple forms. So that's a mystery. And, maybe God is playing a hand in this too. We don't know. Scientists basically take the premise that that the world was set up whether there was a God or not, and they tried not to comment on that, but basically that there are physical laws that operate outside of the realm of spiritual laws and outside of the realm of miracles. But I happen to believe in miracles, and so I wonder how all this sort of works in there. And then on from this explosion, this Cambrian explosion of life, then we have the development of life as indicated on those sheets that I passed out. You know, going from basically from some of these early crustacean-like things into fishes, and then the fishes evolving into amphibians and so on into reptiles, and then reptiles into dinosaurs and birds and mammals and so on up to human beings. I found it very interesting to do some of this reading that turns out that human beings, Homo sapiens, the species that of modern humans that we are, have really only been around on the earth about 40,000 years. There were several other earlier forms in the genus Homo. Homo habilis and Homo erectus were two of them. It was also interesting to find out how closely related we are to chimpanzees. I didn't realize this until I was doing some of this. In our genes, there are just a tiny fraction of our chromosomes are different from those of chimpanzees. And in fact, we're more closely related to chimpanzees than chimpanzees are related to gorillas or any other monkeys.
What about this missing link? Evolution is fairly definable until you all of a sudden get to man, and there seems to be a big leap there, this missing link.
Well, I think that's more a product of the press and sort of old beliefs that were, the term missing link was really sort of back in the days of the Scopes trial and turn of the century when a lot of the scientific evidence and a lot of the fossils haven't been found. Awful lot of very interesting fossils have turned up in the last 30, 40 years from East Africa. A lot of the work of the Leakeys, both the earlier Louis Leakey and his son Richard and Louis's wife, whose name I forget, they were all paleontologists a lot of fossils, which truly are sort of halfway between modern human beings and the apes, do exist. They have been found.
So there's no missing link, as you understand it now.
Well, there isn't for the reason that how do you define the missing link? At what point is it the exact halfway point? All of these fossils, and now they have maybe 18 or 20 different species of these early sort of proto-human fossils and very advanced apes. And so, you know, which one do you define as the missing link? And it is, in fact, very much in tune with the way Darwin envisioned it. It's a very progressive, very gradual change from one type to the next, to the next, to the next. So there's really no one that you can point to and call the missing link.
Can you just in the thumbnail give us carbon?
Carbon 14?
No, carbon. Yeah, markings and how it works, et cetera, et cetera. Probably everybody's aware of this, but
carbon dating.
Carbon dating. Okay, yeah, that's carbon 14. That's a technique that's used to date organic matter, and it has many properties similar to, or many aspects that are similar to all the other radiometric dating techniques that we use to date rocks and date the age of the Earth. Essentially, all the methods make use of the fact that some elements have forms which we call isotopes. And actually, a lot of this is on the sheet, in the first page of the sheets I handed out, that will explain this too, a little more in background. But isotopes are both stable and unstable, and we have these different forms of elements, such as carbon, with the addition of neutrons. Now, what makes carbon carbon is the fact that it has six protons, and it has an atomic number of six. You add six neutrons, that gives it atomic weight of 12, and six and six is a stable configuration for carbon. So the most common and the most stable carbon isotope is carbon 12. Now there are a few other isotopes, and these are often caused by, in the case of carbon, caused by the bombardment of normal carbon by cosmic rays, and it destabilizes the normal carbon. And we have carbon isotopes, carbon 13, it has one extra neutron, and carbon 14, which has two extra neutrons. Carbon 14 happens to be radioactive, and that means it's unstable and it decays naturally. We know what the proportion of normal carbon 12 and radioactive carbon 14 is in the atmosphere. We also know that it's varied somewhat over time, and we have a pretty good idea of what that variation has been. So we know what the original carbon, what the proportion of these two isotopes was in carbon dioxide. And carbon is most prevalent in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So what happens is a plant is growing, for example. In 1 year, its leaves are using carbon dioxide in photosynthesis, so it's taking in this proportion of radioactive carbon and normal carbon. But once it's fixed in the cell walls of the plant, it can no longer take in new carbon. So the ratio of carbon 12 to carbon 14 starts to change due to decay of the radioactive carbon 14. And so in the simplest of terms, what a scientist does in using it as a dating method measures that relative proportion of the two carbons to get an idea of how long that's been sitting there and how long that atomic clock of carbon 14 has been ticking away and decaying away. And that's the basic principle behind all the dating methods that use radioactive isotopes. Yeah.
That's got a limit in terms of how long it's good for.
It does.
Of the decay. What is the time limit? How far back can you look with carbon 14 dating?
It works back in the best and most accurate labs back to about 60 or 70,000 years. And the reason is carbon decays fairly quickly. Carbon 14 decays quickly. Well, it's sort of intermediate. It has a half-life of 5,000 years. Now, radioactive decay is not like an hourglass, where if you turn an hourglass upside down, you have a constant rate of sand falling from one compartment to the other. In radioactive decay, it's an exponential decrease. So that at any given period of time, in the case of carbon, it's 5,500 years, half of the carbon 14 atoms decay. In the next 5,500 years, the remaining half, or half of the half decay, so a quarter of the original amount decay, and so on. So that kind of stretches it out to 70,000 years.
Yeah. How do they measure way back into these millions and hundreds of millions of years on your chart?
In that case, they don't use carbon. They use other elements that have much longer half-lives.
Like what?
Such as certain isotopes of uranium, which decay to lead. And they have a half-life of many hundreds of millions or billions of years. So they can reach all the way back to the time of the beginning of the Earth. Another common one is potassium, what was called potassium-argon dating, where a radioactive potassium decays to a stable argon form. Okay, and just finally, just in the last few minutes, I wanted to share with you some really interesting experiments about that shed light on how life might have evolved on Earth. The early Earth had an atmosphere that's very different from what we have now. It was full of carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, nitrogen, hydrogen sulfide, ammonia, methane, and hydrogen. Most of those are poisonous to life today. In 1953, a scientist by the name of Harold Urey did an experiment. And he took some methane, some ammonia, some hydrogen, and some water, put it in a flask, and then zapped it with electrical charges for a week. And they opened the flask up after that and found that there was brown scum inside this flask. He analyzed this brown scum and found that it contained 4 amino acids, urea, and several fatty acids, all very important and complex organic compounds that are present in life today. And not only that, this experiment was then, again, a good example of the scientific method. He published it. Other people said, wow! And so they rushed off to replicate the experiment. And they tried to do exactly what he did, but they also used other mixtures of gas. And then not only did they, they tried other things, like they tried zapping it with ultraviolet light, they just heated it up. And they found that they were able to synthesize complex organic molecules by these other methods too. So it wasn't the exact ratio of the initial gases wasn't the important thing. So the conclusion that has come out of this is that the building blocks of life we have today, these organic compounds, these proteins, are not just a random occurrence, but there is some sort of self-ordering that they like to kind of hook themselves up in certain ways. And given the chance, given an energy input, and given the raw materials available to extract the building blocks to do this, these things just naturally do that. And it's an inorganic process. I mean, it just happens. It doesn't require life to be present for this to happen. And then in some results of experiment by Sidney Fox in 1977 took this even further. He took some amino acids and combined them and then heated these amino acids up in again in sort of a flask and found that the amino acids that he used polymerized, and that means that they combined into even more complex forms. And then went and found that when these polymers were mixed with water, or allowed to mix with water, they formed what he called proteinoid microspheres. In other words, they were made of material very similar to proteins, and then they arranged themselves structurally in these little balls, microspheres. And these microspheres had a number of very interesting properties. One was that they formed a double-layered membrane, very much like a cell membrane. This membrane allowed, it had a selective diffusion. It allowed small molecules to pass through the membrane, but it blocked big molecules from passing through. This is a process or a property that cell membranes have that's very important for cell metabolism. They had electrically active surfaces, and they, if left undisturbed, they would grow by absorbing other proteinoid material from around them. They formed buds like yeast and bacteria, and they divided, and they were also able to move. Taking some of these ones that were created experimentally and artificially fossilizing them in some sort of resin and then taking photographs of them, it turns out the photographs of these artificial fossils are almost identical to some of the oldest fossils that are found in the Precambrian rocks back, 3.5 billion years ago. And in this book, if you want to look at him after, he's got photographs of the real fossils and these artificial fossils, and it's remarkable how similar they look. And also, another incredible thing, he called them protocells. And in the presence, if these protocells were allowed to take in then some other amino acids, which are the building blocks for DNA, these little microspheres somehow were able to organize these proteins into more complex DNA-like strands. So the dividing line between where life really begins and where these complex organic reactions take place is really a pretty fuzzy one. And I guess to me, I come away with just an incredible sense of awe about how this works. And far from the science weakening my own faith, I find my own faith just all the more enforced and broadened by just this incredible story of how this all works.